Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Kyle Mabry is at the controls. This morning, we have a health topic for you. We try throughout the year to give you various opportunities to talk with people who specialize in dealing with different parts of the body. We have a family practice doctor who's here every other month. And then from time to time, we ask people who are specialists to come and answer questions. And this morning, we'll be talking about the digestive system and take GI questions. Our guest for the program is Dr. Claudia Nugent. She is a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic in Champaign. And she, I know, would do her best to answer questions, whatever they might be. You want to talk about cancer, ulcer, reflux, any of the things that can affect the digestive system. Give us a call, and she'll do her best to help you out. When I have physicians here on the program, one of the things I try to urge people to keep in mind is that we can't diagnose over the telephone. There are limits as to what the doctor can do because she can't see you. And if you have a real serious issue, you might want to pursue that with somebody who can. But it's a place that you can start. You can ask some basic questions. And we hope that by doing these programs, we add to your general base of knowledge about health. So if you'd like to talk with the doctor, you can do that by calling us. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions are welcome. Well, thanks very much for being here.
I'm glad to be here.
I was thinking about the fact that it seems that when I was growing up, the big GI problem people used to talk about, it seems that they used to talk about a lot, was ulcers. And it seems like now the big GI problem people talk a lot about is reflux disease. And I don't know when the last time I really ever heard anyone talk very much about ulcers, having them, concerns about them. Is the rate of ulcer disease what it was, say, in the 50s and 60s, or is there less of it?
The overall rate is probably down a little bit, more because we know a little bit more why ulcers occur. We know there are certain medicines that cause ulcers, and so people that have issues that or make them prone to ulcers or a situation where they've already had ulcer disease, we know that non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs such as Aleve or ibuprofen, naproxen, typical arthritis treatment-type medicines can cause ulcer problems. And if you already have a history of having had ulcers from those medicines, then your risk is very, very high of getting them again if you take those medicines. And so that's certainly a risk factor. So that education has probably decreased that potential for formation of ulcer disease. And we also know that bacteria that's been associated with ulcers, Helicobacter pylori or H. pylori, that was in the news several years ago, if you have that and you have ulcers, your risk of getting more ulcers is much higher. And therefore, the adage of once an ulcer patient, always an ulcer patient may not be true anymore, because if you would treat for the H. pylori and get rid of it, then the potential of getting ulcer diseases again seems to go down back to the normal population level. There are, however, a population of patients that get ulcer disease that are not related to any medications or the H. pylori. We're not sure what those risk factors are. And those patients seem to be seeing more of those probably because we have taken away some of the other risk factors for ulcer disease.
Hmm. So if you do have somebody who has ulcer because they have the H. pylori and you treat that, if you can then get rid of that, then the chances are pretty good that that person then would be ulcer-free for the rest of their life?
Yes, yes. And the potential of them getting reinfected is very, very low.
How do you come across the H. pylori? I mean, how does somebody get that into them?
Pretty much it's in dirt. So it's just one of these bacteria that hang around. And so if you're exposed to it, we probably inoculate ourselves. The thought is that gastroenterologists have a very high rate of H. pylori because we deal so much with people's stomachs and people that are already infected or inoculated or that simply is around. H. pylori does not always cause ulcer disease, but certainly if it's there when the ulcers are there, you need to get rid of it.
Yeah. So it sounds as if you're saying we could go out and maybe if we put together a representative sample of people, we could test and we could find some people who had H. pylori in their gut, wherever, but we're fine.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, it's in the Western countries, it's pretty much age-related. So say about 10% of 10-year-olds will have H. pylori present in their stomachs. Mm-hmm. And it goes up along with age, so 30% of 30-year-olds, up to about 60 to 65% of 60 and 65-year-olds, and then does not seem to increase beyond that. If you go to other developing countries in Africa, some in the Middle East, then it's almost 70% of 20-year-olds are already infected. But, of course, the ulcer rates are not nearly that high. So what exactly potentiates the H. pylori to actually cause the ulcer, or for the ulcers then to form, and it happens to be around already, so it keeps ulcers reforming, I think is really the question that has not been answered.
All right. We have several callers here. Let's talk with them. We're starting out with someone in Onarga on our toll-free line. This is line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. My husband has problems with his stomach. A year ago, this past January, he had his gallbladder removed, and thought maybe things would be resolved. However, he still has had problems, and the doctor had put him on some Nexium. Yesterday afternoon or morning, I'm not sure which time it was, on the station, there was an interview with a doctor, and I thought it was up in Cleveland, and he mentioned that the PPI, which I think is, I can't tell you what the letters stand for, it's something to do with the type of medication Nexium is, and I think Prilosec maybe.
Right.
And that many of these are given, and he compared it to killing a fly with a shotgun, because then people will maybe still have stomach problems because your body continues to try and overcome what that PPI medication is supposedly taking care of. And they recommended trying to get off something like that, but to go off gradually so that you go between the Nexium one day and Zantac another day and kind of wean yourself from this kind of thing. And I just thought that was kind of interesting. And then here this morning you show up, and I thought, well, maybe I could confirm that this was a valid thing to do, because he's ready to try anything. He still has some problems.
Well, he probably should visit again with his physician just for follow-up to find out what's going on. But first of all, the PPI stands for proton pump inhibitor.
That's right.
Right, and the proton pump is one of the major acid-producing mechanisms in the stomach. And the Nexium, the Prilosec, and the list goes on of the world are very, very effective at shutting down acid, because they work against that pump, so that the hydrogen, which is a proton pump, can't be secreted into the stomach and form hydrochloric acid. The medicines, the proton pump inhibitors, are very, very safe. There's very few side effects and hardly any serious side effects from these medicines. So I think that makes people feel better handing them out. They're also that kind of shotgun approach. It does work a lot of times, because reflux disease is so common that a lot of patients may be having some symptoms from that. And since it is so common, you're using a medicine that's very effective for that type of disease, the majority are going to get better. It's not a bad approach. In fact, I think a lot of primary care physicians, that's actually part of their protocol of taking care of patients for GI issues, and what is sanctioned by their boards, is this is the next thing to try. But if people don't get better, then you've got to evaluate a little bit further. As a gastroenterologist, I'd like to think of myself a little bit more as a purist, because that was my training.
Uh-huh.
And so when people are sent to me, they've already gone through a lot of those trials, and then I can be the purist and try to pick out exactly what are we dealing with. If you're not getting better, then probably is not reflux disease, and we need to investigate further.
Okay. Well, should I try to encourage him then to make a new appointment and check with his doctor on this?
Yeah, it sounds like it. It sounds like it. If he's still having problems.
All right. Well, thank you for your help, and it was very coincidental that these two programs ran back to back.
Well, I'm glad we could help.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Claudia Nugent. She is a gastroenterologist from Christie Clinic in Champaign. And if you have digestive questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Champaign, line one.
Good morning, Dr. Nugent. I just had a colonoscopy this past spring and came out clean as a whistle. But my understanding is that this does not get you all the way to the small intestine. And my concern on that is that I lost a father to cancer of the small intestine years ago. And I'm just wondering how is the best way to monitor that. And I will take my answer off the air.
Okay. Congratulations on your colonoscopy results. And small intestinal tumors are quite rare, and they're not nearly as common as colon cancers, and therefore screening of the small intestine is not done very frequently. It would really depend on the type of tumor that your father had as to if there's any type of risk factor for you at all. There are carcinoids, which are not usually hereditary. There are lymphomas. So it really is. It depends exactly what the cell type was of the cancer that was in the small intestine in your father's case. There are certain tumors that do need to be screened for, but again, it's so case-dependent and cell-dependent that it's hard to say much more than that.
Okay. Well, again, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's go to another caller here, someone in Chicago. Line number four. Hello.
Thank you. Some people can handle spices and hot foods of that sort readily, and I know that some people of the hot Mexican, Latino, and other European and Asian curries and so forth, they handle them, and they seem to benefit their systems. I presume otherwise they wouldn't keep on doing that. But just what happens when we ingest some of those hot jalapenos and habanero peppers and other things that are seasoned to that point? Of course, you think you're going to be scorched because of the heat factor. But is there any harm in taking those kind of things?
No, not that we know of at all, in fact. The spiciness is actually a chemical reaction in the mouth and the taste buds rather than anything in our stomachs. And in fact, they've done studies that show that even patients that have have ulcer disease, spicy foods don't make ulcer disease and they don't keep ulcers from healing. So there's really no contraindication to having spicy foods, even if you have a known ulcer that you're trying to get healed.
Yeah, the benefits are there as a result of the spices. They seem to enhance the many health conditions like circulation. People seem to thrive on it. So I think we shouldn't be too afraid of ingesting those things as long as they're agreeable. Thank you.
Sure.
All right, thank you. Let me go back just for a second here, and we have some other callers we'll get to ask a couple of basic questions about reflux. We've talked about that before, and it's something that's certainly got plenty of coverage in popular media. I expect that as long as there have been human beings, probably there's been indigestion. But is that truly what reflux is? I mean, is that just a technical name for something that a symptom that people have been probably experiencing and complaining about for a very long time?
Well, indigestion is a symptom, and it's not a diagnosis, whereas reflux disease is a diagnosis. So is your indigestion from having overeaten, from drinking too much coffee? Is it because you have an ulcer? Is it because you have reflux or because you have gallbladder disease? So it's a vague symptom but not a diagnosis.
Mm, okay. So then when does the point come when you would say the symptom is serious enough? Because I expect probably a lot of people would say, on occasion, I experience what I would describe as heartburn, and it's kind of feels like what it sounds like. When does something that's just maybe an occasional problem become something that you might say it would be good to have a conversation with your doctor about?
Well, you know, if you're having a problem a couple times a month or a couple times a year, that's obviously, it's not a big deal in response to taking antacid, over-the-counter antacid, that's not considered serious, probably doesn't need further evaluation. If you're having daily symptoms or frequently throughout the week and you have tried medicines, and again, many of these medicines are over-the-counter, even Prilosec is now available over-the-counter. But if you read the box label, it says if you have symptoms for more than 2 weeks, it's not responding to this medicine, then it's time to be evaluated.
Okay. And reflux disease, now, this is the thing that's the problem is the opening there in between the stomach and the esophagus.
Right.
Which is the tube that the food goes down to go into the stomach. The problem is that muscle that's there, that's it's not working the way that it's supposed to.
Right, right. For the most part, people that have reflux issues, it's the muscle's just a little bit too weak, and so it's not keeping things down in the stomach that are supposed to be down in the stomach. Everyone has a normal amount of reflux by studies that have measured how much acid is supposed to be considered normal. Once it goes beyond that level, then it's considered abnormal. Now, some people have symptoms from even a normal amount of reflux, mm-hmm. And some people don't have symptoms from an immense amount of reflux. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah. Do you all in the gastro community have some kind of ideas why it seems to be that they're now that the reflux, number of people who have this condition seems to have been going up?
Well, I think more people are becoming more aware of the problem because of all the medicines that, and again, advertisements are making us more aware of all the medicines, including prescription medicines that you didn't necessarily hear about except from your physician, are now plastered all over TV and ads and newspapers, magazines, et cetera. And so I think we're becoming more aware of it. The obesity issue in the United States also continues to increase, and obesity is one of the risk factors for reflux problems. So the incidence probably is also increasing as our average weight increases.
Hmm. For a long time, I think the standard prescription medication that people took to reduce the stomach acid production was the drugs like Pepcid or Zantac, and there are some others that are now and have been for some time now available over the counter. Those used to be prescription medicines.
Right.
And they are all one particular class, and they work in one particular way. And then these other medicines, the newer ones, the proton pump inhibitors, like Prilosec. Yeah, I should know that. I've been taking it for a few years. Prilosec comes along that apparently works. It works in a different way.
Right.
And that is also now available over the counter. So if someone was going to choose, say, between those two things, the older one, say, if you're going to choose between Pepcid and Prilosec, what would you say? Are they essentially going to do the same thing? So you'd say, well, pick whichever one you want?
Well, it really depends on the severity and the frequency of the heartburn issues or the reflux issues. H2 blockers are antihistamine agents like Tagamet and Zantac and Pepcid and Axid, I think, was the last one, and there's those four, do a nice job of decreasing the amount of acid that's produced. But the way they work, that mechanism, is not the biggest way of producing acid in the stomach. So they're not quite as strong as a Prilosec. However, having said that, they have action within usually about 30 minutes of taking them. So if you're having an occasional heartburn issue and you want relief now, then an H2 blocker is going to give you that relief very soon. Whereas if you're taking a Prilosec, your relief will be tomorrow because the maximum effect of Prilosec is usually within about 24 hours of taking it. So you may have some effect within 6 hours of taking it, but tomorrow you'll feel much better. And in that case, probably the H2 blocker is more appropriate for that occasional heartburn that's not that severe and you want to have something that works right now.
Yeah. And if you have somebody, one of these people who has occasional symptoms and they really want to get some relief right now, would you have any problem with somebody, say, taking a Pepcid and also popping some Tums at the same time?
Not at all, because the Tums gives you effective relief of your symptoms now. It works immediately within minutes of taking it because of direct contact effect. And then within 30 minutes, then the H2 blocker, the Pepcid, will have an effect. And many of these medicines actually now have combination forms, Pepcid Complete. I believe there's a Tagamet version out there, too, that are chewable, keep them in your purse, your pocket, and they use exactly those two mechanisms to give more immediate relief of symptoms.
But I'm sure that you would say if you find yourself doing this a few times a week and that goes on week after week, your advice would be you go to your doctor and talk to them about what's going on.
Yeah. You probably need something more than that.
All right. We have several callers, and we'll go right to, let's see, line number one, someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
I'm calling because my husband and I have had a conversation about a problem that he has. I'm wondering, is it he has kind of chronic diarrhea, tends to defecate perhaps 3 times a day on average. I'm saying this is not normal, and I'm pushing him to have a colonoscopy. He had one about probably 4 years ago, and I'm wondering what you would say about this.
I guess it depends on if it's a new problem or an old problem, or if it's a problem at all, quite honestly. What is normal as far as number of bowel movements varies from once a week to 5 to 6 times a day.
Oh.
Yeah, it's quite a range. And, yeah, as long as it's, you know, not a painful, crampy, bloody diarrhea, that type of thing. And this is real variable for each person. If it's a change, a sudden change in bowel habits, you know, where he previously had one bowel movement a day to every other day and now suddenly is having 3 times a day, then things need to be looked at. But colonoscopy is actually not the first step probably in evaluating that.
Oh. So what would be?
Well, you have to think about medicines changing the number of bowel movements that you have. You think about infections. There is actually a parasite called Giardia which is quite common that we can get either from small kids or from water sources that can give actually variable diarrhea where people will have some problems for a few weeks and it can go away and then come back again. Looking at things like fat malabsorption that can also increase the number of bowel movements a day, all that needs to be looked at, especially if he's had a fairly recent colonoscopy. So those would be probably the first steps for evaluation of that. And, you know, if this is what he has done all his life, then 3 times a day is normal.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Right, you're welcome.
Very good. Thank you. Let's go to line 3. This is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Yeah, hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Moved up fast. I didn't know that was moved up on the list so quickly. You know, we hear a lot about, you know, coffee and all that kind of stuff, good, bad, all that kind of, and certainly when you have a lot, not good for you. But what's your feeling about it in terms of the impact?
Well, I think a lot of anything is not good for you. That's, I think, an age-old adage that my mother always taught me, and she's probably right. Small doses of caffeine, and I'll go for the caffeine and the coffee, have shown some beneficial effects. And I've seen studies that have shown that athletes perform better if they drink 1 or 2 cups of coffee a day. When I was in medical school, there was a scare that maybe there was an association with increased coffee intake and pancreatic cancers. And, of course, we medical students all panicked. But we're very relieved when that was kind of pushed aside. So there's always some studies that go both ways as to is it beneficial or not. Caffeine can increase the amount of reflux you have because it relaxes that lower esophageal sphincter. Again, I go back to my mother's teachings, which is a small amount is okay, and I usually say 1 to 2 doses a day is reasonable, even in a patient that has reflux. But if you go beyond that, it's probably not good for you because it has a lot of effects. Caffeine also has a stimulant effect on the GI tract, can cause people to have diarrhea and infrequent bowel movements. There's also a fair amount of acid in coffee. So those are all things to consider when you're deciding how much you should be drinking or not drinking.
Okay. So quickly, what about, is the tea better or not? I know that still has, you know, same thing in terms of the impact, but you know, a lot of people say, well, drinking tea is better. Is that not the case or not?
There are some questions about whether tea might be protective as well because of the other ingredients in it. Again, it depends on what types of tea. But if you're going back to the caffeine, amount of caffeine that you have in it, it depends on how strong your tea is, quite honestly, and how much what your intake is, really.
Okay, so the reality is you never would have got through med school if it wasn't for coffee, right?
Well, it certainly helped us along.
Great problem.
Thanks for noticing.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Other questions are certainly welcome. Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Claudia Nugent. She is a gastroenterologist. So if you have questions about the digestive system, that's what it is that she deals with in her practice. Call us 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. It seem to be a number of things that the people who have reflux and complain about heartburn are warned about. Caffeine is one of them. So it's not
right.
Just coffee. There are different things that have caffeine in them.
Exactly.
Alcohol, of course, would be another thing. The non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, starting with aspirin and then other kinds of medications. Nicotine, apparently, is another one. Are those sort of the big four things?
Yeah, and actually, as far as increasing reflux or being irritating if there's already irritated area in the esophagus, the other things actually are also mint and tomatoes, because the mint tomatoes also have chemicals that relax the lower esophageal sphincter and the lower esophagus to potentially increase the amount of reflux you have. It's tomato season, you know, that's kind of hard.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you have to, nothing of too much should ever be taken in.
Yeah.
That's kind of the bottom line on that.
Yeah. And it seems also that maybe individuals, different people have different sort of levels of sensitivities. Maybe they can tolerate one thing pretty well, but something else, no, they can't hardly tolerate it.
Sure, sure. And that's very individual.
Yeah. Well, again, questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Oh, I know what I wanted to ask you. What's the track record now for people taking the proton pump inhibitors? As far as you know, how long can you keep taking these medicines?
As far as we know, you can take them pretty much lifelong. There are certainly situations where people have taken them for many, many years and probably lifelong. These agents were available in Europe before they were available here. And although the original studies suggested that if you're a rat, there's an increased risk of rare stomach cancers, that has never been shown to be the case in humans, which is good, and it's not been shown in any other animals. I know when they first came out, we suggested that people have an endoscopy potentially every so often to look for those tumors before it was realized that humans were not at risk, and also to measure certain enzyme levels. But none of that is done anymore. There's also been some concern because calcium and iron are absorbed best in an acid medium, and so because of how nicely the proton pump inhibitors work, potentially and theoretically, you would have decreased absorption of both of those electrolytes and vitamins. That has never been shown to be an issue, actually, with iron, even though theoretically people should become iron deficient if they're on proton pump inhibitors lifelong. It doesn't happen. We still are able to absorb the iron fairly well, so it's not an issue. I know there have been some papers suggesting there may be increased risk of osteoporosis with long-term use of proton pump inhibitors, again, for that same reason of decreased calcium absorption. But I think that's been it's been an association only. And although I would caution patients to make sure that they take enough calcium in, I don't think that really has been proven.
Okay. Other callers here. We'll start in with someone in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, I'm also calling about the PPIs. Several years ago, I took, let me say first of all, that I think I heard just this weekend, I believe, and I think it was on the People's Pharmacy, and maybe you talked about this, of a problem of after using PPIs, then if you stop taking them, there's a danger of sudden rebound and tremendous acid reflux amount of acid that you hadn't had before.
Yeah. Someone did, an earlier caller, and I think that's what they were talking about, that particular
yeah. I'm not sure we really addressed it, and it's a very good point that you make, that if you're on proton pump inhibitors for a while, or for more than probably a few months, that if you try to stop, you should really wean off, because if you suddenly withdraw that medicine, all these little cells that were supposed to be producing acid are now able to produce acid, and there's a rebound effect, and if you didn't have reflux before, you probably will by stopping it suddenly. So it's a point to be well taken that you should be weaning off those medicines rather than just stopping them cold turkey.
Yes, well, that's my experience was I was on Prevacid for a year, and then I decided that a year was enough, and so I stopped. And I didn't have acid reflux thing, but I suddenly had the most massive constipation.
Well, that's interesting.
And then, so at that point, not long after that, I switched to Prilosec, and I think that was because of the state of Illinois program, prescription program recommended that rather than the very expensive Prevacid. And I've been on that now for several years, but I've gradually been weaning myself off. First of all, I think I would skip a day, and then actually I think I went from 2 out of 3 days to 2 out of 4 days. Now I'm at 2 out of 5 days, and I'm going to keep on going to 2 out of 6 days. It seems that if I go off too quickly, then the constipation comes back. But so far, I've been managing that.
Yeah, actually, it's kind of an interesting point. One of the side effects, the minor side effects that proton pump inhibitors have potentially is to cause diarrhea or looser bowel movements. And some people have that to the point that they can't take them. The incidence of that is probably somewhere between 5 and 10%. Also, the point to be made is that everything is interrelated. Just because we're just affecting the stomach doesn't mean that there's not some other effect, therefore, on the colon, because there are so many other mechanisms that are involved that are very complex, many of which we don't even understand. So I think that's interesting that you became constipated when you went off, but it certainly makes sense. The other thing to realize, too, as you wean yourself off a proton pump inhibitor is most patients that have reflux disease have them chronically. 85% of people that have a reflux issue because of the mechanisms involved, that's an adage, once a reflux patient, probably almost always a reflux patient unless there was some other issue. So you may be able to wean off, but you may end up having to go back on at least intermittently.
Yep. Okay, thank you.
Sure.
All right, very good. Let's see. The next caller is in Fisher, line 2. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I was recently had a colonostomy and was diagnosed with everything was fine, except you said I had diverticulitis.
Right.
What is it? What's it caused by? What can I do about it? I didn't get much from my doctor, to be quite honest about it.
I'm sorry. I hope that wasn't me.
No.
Okay. Well, then let me take it from there.
I'll hang up, and then thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Diverticulosis is actually a weakening, and actually what you had probably was diverticulosis, which are pockets that form off the wall of the intestine. It's most common on the left side of the intestine, large intestine. And it's very common in the United States because our fiber intake as we grow and get older is very, very low compared to other countries. And these are areas of the colon wall that are weak. They start to pooch out probably from pressures as we're having bowel movements and pressures of harder stool, less bulkier stool in the colon, and they form little pockets. Now, they're not precancerous. We see them in almost everyone over the age of 50. If hard stool gets lodged in those openings, then those pockets cannot drain. And if they can't drain, then you can develop diverticulitis, which is actually an inflammation and potential infection of those areas. And that usually needs to be treated with antibiotics and sometimes even surgery if it becomes very severe. Most people that have diverticulosis will never have a problem from that. But we always recommend make sure you are on a high fiber diet and and maybe even take a fiber supplement such as Metamucil, Citracell, Benefiber to decrease the risk of having issues from the diverticulosis itself.
Now, because I think because we're being told it's good to have fiber in your diet, it's maybe a little bit easier to calculate how much fiber you're getting. At least a lot of things now, packaged foods, will say in a serving, here's the amount of fiber that you're getting.
Right.
And then it may be a little bit more difficult depending on, you know, what else you have to figure out yourself. If you're eating broccoli, how much fiber you're getting. Is there actually a number that's recommended for daily fiber intake?
There is, and I'm not going to even quote it because I can't remember the exact number and I don't want to quote wrong. But I know the fiber supplements that we recommend, usually you should add about 4 to 6 grams of fiber a day in those. With those, because there's so much variability in the diet itself. And off the top of my head, I'm thinking 30 to 50 grams of fiber is what's usually recommended a day. But
well, actually, this will give me an opportunity to mention that coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, they'll be doing their monthly show on diet and nutrition. And registered dietitian Susan Kundrat will be on the show.
She'll be a much better expert.
She will know.
There you
so
go.
She would be the one to ask the question.
Yeah.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580, Dr. Claudia Nugent. She's a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic in Champaign. We're talking about things that have to do with the digestive system. So if you have questions, you give us a call. And I got some other folks here, so we'll try to get everybody. Next is someone in Champaign, and this would be line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm calling because I have some concern about my 80-year-old auntie who does occasionally have reflux, acid reflux, and then she'll sometimes complain that it feels as if she has a balloon in her esophagus. The way she insists upon treating it is with baking soda. Is this dangerous?
No.
It's about a half a teaspoon of baking soda. She may do it 3 times in a row, and then she says, oh, I get a huge burp, and I feel great.
Yeah. The baking soda is actually what's in antacids, sodium bicarbonate. And so she's suppressing some of the effects of the acid by direct contact and settling out the acid in her stomach to a certain extent. So if she's, you know, as long as she's not taking the whole box at a time, she's probably doing fine.
Thank you.
Sure.
All right, thank you. On to, let's see, Champagne. This would be line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had 2 quick questions for your guest, and then I'll go ahead and ring off. You mentioned earlier in the show about ulcers and what causes them. I've got a 14-year-old daughter that has a pyloric spasm, and she's been taking a muscle relaxant now for, about 6 years, and it's been working out very nicely, no complications. My question is, I'm just wondering, because of that situation, would that make her prone to getting ulcers later in her life, if there's any correlation there? And then the other question I had is, I read somewhere, and I forgive my ignorance, but I read somewhere that coffee and beer raises one's cysteine levels, if I'm correct in saying that. And I have no idea what that is, if it's good or bad, or even if it's true. And I was wondering if you guys could comment. I'll listen off air. Thanks.
I have no idea if those raise cysteine levels or not, and I'll let our nutritionist
that one. Call in at 1 o'clock.
Sorry about that. As far as the pyloric spasm in your daughter, that is along the realms of an irritable bowel, irritable intestinal issue, which is real common and maybe actually be something that she grows out of. Because those are effects sometimes from stress, sometimes hormonally related, and it's actually just a movement disorder, if you will, of the opening between the stomach and the duodenum, which is the first part of the small intestine. The antispasmodics are very indiscriminate, and they work in the upper GI tract and in the lower GI tract. So I think if someone says they have irritable bowel, then I think it's okay to have it in the upper GI tract as well as the lower GI tract, but there is another word for that, which is non-ulcer dyspepsia. It's not as popular a term, but it seems to be more involved the upper GI tract. It does not increase the risk of ulcer disease down the road at all. So should calm your fears with that.
Okay. Someone on a cell phone near Catlin. Line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a couple of questions. One, could your guest explain the difference between gluten intolerance and celiac disease? And I have a daughter that, the way the doctor explained it, because she kept vomiting all the time, particularly after meals and late at night, that she had a lack of hormone at the base of her stomach that wouldn't allow her food to pass through. And in doing some reading here a while back, because as she became older and began to have children, she also was a gestational diabetic. And when I was doing some reading, I read where that can be caused from undiagnosed gestational diabetes, and which led me to wonder if I was an undiagnosed gestational diabetic when during the time I was pregnant with her. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. I'll try to tackle the more difficult question first. The vomiting and the lack of a hormone in the stomach, I'm really not sure where that comes from and what the ideas are behind it. And so that's going to be hard to explain. We're not really aware that any gestational diabetes issues should cause a loss of a hormone permanently or there'd be a long-term effect from that. Certainly diabetes by itself can decrease gastric emptying and stomach emptying simply because it just doesn't function right. And if blood sugars are well controlled, that is less of an issue. So I hope that has addressed some of the question that you had there. Glucose intolerance is pretty much celiac disease. And I'll, with a caveat of there is a trend of a new wheat-free or a low-wheat diet. People sometimes change their diet so they have less wheat intake and they seem to feel better. But that is not celiac disease and that is not gluten intolerance. Celiac disease is actually a genetic disease that is an allergy to the gluten that is found in wheat, barley, and rye, to name a few. And there's actually an inflammatory response in the small intestine.
Okay. So and this is the kind of thing that in most people simply responds to a change of diet. If you just get the gluten, the things that have the gluten, if you don't eat those things, generally that you can have a significant improvement just from
that? Yes, it should actually normalize. Okay. The trick is actually getting the gluten out because there are so many, there's so much gluten and wheat and things that we don't even think about. Now, I believe in beginning of 2008, FDA required that all products must list whether there is potential gluten, as well as nuts and lactose, and other food intolerances, that they're on the labels and that they're easy to read so that lay people can read and understand what's actually in the contents of the food that they're eating. So it's become somewhat a little bit easier, but it can be really challenging. Very, very challenged to actually be on a gluten-free diet.
Yeah. Well, we have talked quite a bit about acid reflux, which is this condition that results when acid from the stomach comes up into the esophagus because that muscle that's there at the door of the stomach is weaker than it should be, and it doesn't do the job that it should of keeping the contents of the stomach in the stomach.
Right.
I guess there can also be people who have a problem with the food moving as it should through the system. They have motility problems, which also there are medications that can treat that as well.
Right.
How many people have problems like that? And can that either exacerbate reflux or create some of the same symptoms?
Most people that have, quote, motility disorders, unquote, of the gut are probably patients that have they're mild variability and abnormalities and what is supposedly is normal. And there's so much variability within normal that it can be very, very difficult to measure. But most of those patients are probably of an irritable bowel sort of an issue where movement overall is fine, but there's variability. There may be some hard spasms. They may have discomfort with that. But things do move through. The absorption is fine. There are other entities, however, that do actually affect movement. And I will use diabetes because that's a common example, although luckily this is not a common side effect of diabetes except in very severe diabetics where the small intestine has been the innervation, the nerve supply to the small intestine has been affected, and things are not moving correctly at all, and that can have a severe effect on absorption. And certainly things can back up, and that potentially would increase reflux problems. The most common problem that diabetics actually have is what's called gastroparesis, which is a problem where the stomach itself has had an issue with the nerve supply from effects of the diabetes, and therefore the stomach doesn't empty correctly, and that definitely increases the potential for reflux. Mm. And there are other certainly rarer diseases that can also have those effects.
Okay. We talk next with someone in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah. I have somewhat similar problems like the previous callers, perhaps reflux. But I do not have heartburn. However, I have been diagnosed as hernia in the esophagus. And I wonder what the treatment is. The only treatment perhaps is the operation, or is there any other kind of medication or treatment? I will hang up and listen.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Hiatal hernia is, I'm assuming, the diagnosis that has been made here. And this is a very common issue where part of the stomach has gone up through the natural opening in the diaphragm. Normally, the diaphragm is where the esophagus stops and the stomach opens up below that area. And there's a natural opening, of course, in the diaphragm for that to occur. When the hiatal hernia occurs, some of the stomach is actually pouched up through that opening. Small hiatal hernias are extremely common. And for many patients, they probably don't do anything. But certainly they can, because now part of the stomach is up above that protective effect of the diaphragm, can increase the risk of reflux problems, which is then the problem, even though the hiatal hernia is causing it. Large hiatal hernias, luckily, are much more rare, but they certainly increase the risk of significant reflux even more. And extremely large hiatal hernias can actually rotate above the diaphragm and actually cut the blood supply off to the stomach, and that's called a gastric volvulus. That does not happen very often, luckily, but can be a very severe problem, and that definitely requires surgery. Small hiatal hernias rarely require surgery unless reflux is really an issue, and then you're doing the routine anti-reflux surgeries in addition to fixing the hiatal hernia.
Okay. We're coming down here. We have a couple minutes. One thing I just want to make sure that we do, again, just as a kind of routine thing, is to talk about screening for colon cancer. Seems that we've actually made some good progress on dealing with colon cancer, and that's why, because now we have people are going, they're having their colonoscopies, and they're doing the other kind of testing that is recommended just as a non-invasive, as a routine kind of thing. So now what are the standard recommendations?
Oh, they have not changed too much. If for patients that do not have increased risk factors of family history and of someone in the family has had colon cancer under the age of 60 or other obvious risk factors, then routine colon screening should occur at about the age of 50. And a colonoscopy at that time suffices. If no polyps are found, then approximately every 10 years, that should be repeated. There has been a question as to when we should stop colon cancer screening. And I think that's probably the newest thing that I've seen. And there's been a suggestion that maybe over the age of 75, we don't need to do any screening. The caveat, however, in that entire recommendation has been it really depends on the health of the patient. If their patient has a lot of other health issues, then that's probably a reasonable thing to do, is not to screen over age 75. But there are many people that are going to live until their 90s, and the rate of a colon polyp formation and then developing into a cancer is somewhere between 6 and 12 years. And so if you have a very healthy patient, then it may make a lot more sense to continue that colon screening until at least age 85. But again, it depends on the overall status of the patient.
And what do you think about the relative merits of colonoscopy versus flexible sigmoidoscopy?
Well, the prior recommendations were to do sigmoidoscopies at the age of 45 to 50 and repeat them every 3 to 5 years. There are papers, however, that are showing that there are a lot of colon polyps occurring in the right side of the colon, so that using that as a screening parameter is less favorable. It still can be done, but the hemocult cards are also supposed to be continued to be done every year. Mm-hmm. And as long as they stay negative, you could do that. Unfortunately, we know that our hemocult cards, which test for microscopic blood, are also not fantastic. It really has to be very diligently done every year to make sure that there's no changes. It's not the best way to screen for colon cancer, unfortunately, but it certainly still can be done.
Yeah. Just one sort of last question. a lot of people experience digestive complaints with stress, and it's not an easy time. I expect that there are a lot of people, or maybe their stress levels higher than it was a year ago or a couple of years ago. Are you seeing more people, do you think, that have digestive complaints that one way or another are really stress-induced?
I don't think that I have overall. I think primary care physicians have, and that they're doing a good job of taking care of them, that they realize they don't probably need to see a specialist. Having said that, I see a lot of patients with irritable bowel syndrome and stress-induced problems, but I don't think it's really much more than what we've seen in the past.
And what are the easiest sorts of things to do to treat those kinds of problems?
Relax, right? Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Easy for you to say, doctor. Yeah.
That's difficult, and it's a little bit individual. I think sometimes just reassurance if the patients realize that the problems they're having, you know, some people have stress headaches, some people have stress back aches, well, some people have stress stomach aches. That's recognized, and as long as you realize that it's not anything more serious than that, then just reassurance by itself can help. And there's certainly like the caller before said, the antispasm medicine, the antispasmodics that can be used to help relax the GI tract. Because we know adrenaline and epinephrine, which are the same chemical, those are produced during times of extreme stress. And they have a potent effect on promotility and spasming of the GI tract. And it makes sense that people would have symptoms from that.
Yeah. And does diet have any kind of effect?
Well, we always say that high-fiber diets are supposed to help normalize colon motility, and the fiber supplements should help, and they do help overall with irritable bowel syndrome patients for the most part, and so certainly that should be continued.
All right. Well, I thank you very much for being here.
You're welcome.
We appreciate
it. My pleasure.
Our guest, Dr. Claudia Nugent. She is a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic in Champaign. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Champaign Park District. The Champaign Park District and the Champaign-Urbana Symphony present Symphony at Sunset to kick off the 50th anniversary of the CU Symphony at Dodds Park on Saturday, September 19th. There'll be an instrument petting zoo, entertainment, and food vendors before the concert at 7 p.m. More information available at champaignparkdistrict.com. We are WILL, and WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. That's it for us. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine, Celeste Quinn is the host for the show.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, our monthly look at diet and nutrition. Our guest will be registered dietitian Susan Kundrat of Nutrition on the Move. That follows the 1 o'clock news this afternoon. Let's turn our attention to commodity prices in Kansas City. September wheat is trading at 472, down 5. December, 483 and 3 quarters, down 6 and a quarter. September wheat in Chicago, 438, down 6. December, 464 and a half, down 7 and a quarter. September corn, 304 and a half, up 4. December, 308 and 3 quarters, up 2 and a half. March, 322 and a half, up 2 and 3 quarters. May, 331 and 3 quarters, up 2 and a half. September beans, 966 and a quarter, up 5 and a quarter. November, 932 and a half, up 10 and a half. January, 939 and a half, up 12 and a half. March, 942 and 3 quarters, up 15. May, 943, up 16 and a quarter. September meal, 341.40, up 920. September oil, 34.28, up 63. On to the livestock contracts next. October live cattle, 87.45. That contract is up 80 cents. December, 87 even, up 32.5. September feeder cattle, 99.30, up 35. October, 99.15, up 60. October lean hogs,